Hey folks, in a few moments you're going to hear me say it's episode 15, and I normally don't lie to you, but that's kind of a lie, because we changed the episode order in order to talk about the Barr report before this one. This is, well, you'll see what this is, but it's actually episode 16. See you later. Folks, it is episode 15 of The Watcher. I am Connor, and this is Fen.
Hi, Connor.
Hey, man. Before we start, let's talk about the USA Singers. We'll be talking about them throughout the month. They have an album out called The Orange Album. It's out now on Spotify and iTunes. Last week, unfortunately, a little bit after St. Patrick's Day, by the time you heard it, we mentioned their St. Patrick's Day tune. I listened to it, right? I hate St. Patrick's Day. I also have like a real strong discomfort with like people being cod Irish, but that song is fucking hilarious and it's brilliant. It was amazing. Really, really good. Go and listen to it. You don't have to listen to it on St. Patrick's Day. It's like the ballad of Judge Kavanaugh. It's really good. So their album, The Orange Album, is out on Spotify, iTunes, etc. But the quick way to find them is at the USA Singers on Twitter. And then, I guess, as always, a quick word about Lance Cooper. You may have gotten used to us mentioning him by now, but if you have not yet, please take some kind of action. He's at Escape to Matrix on Twitter. He's behind the Save Flint Challenge hashtag. He's been working tirelessly to provide clean water to Flint, but he has plans to do a lot more. They've raised a lot of money for that cause, but they're far from done, and you can help, whether it's a few quid, which is brilliant, or a retweet of his pinned tweets or his most recent tweets. You don't know who you might reach, and you know that could help immeasurably. So please do what you can. With that done, this is part two of what?
This is part two of Article 1 of the Constitution. Although I was thinking, with your approval, of course, because you know it's a team effort, I was thinking we might just roll right over to the executive on the next one. We really haven't talked about like the unitary executive theory and the power that's amassed there. I thought maybe we do like an article two on the next one.
That's fine. Yeah. Yeah. I'm into that.
Okay, cool. I have a couple of questions before we start though.
Proceed.
Can you tell us American what a quid is?
Oh, sorry. quids are, they're like dollars in a way. Yeah. A quid is a, I think it might come from quid pro quo. But it means money, cash, those sweet, sweet dollar bills.
Is it a slang?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what is a cod Irish?
Oh, cod Irish is like, people joking about Ireland, but they're not from Ireland and they're like maybe doing an Irish accent. All that stuff. You'd be amazed how much less Irish people love that than Irish Americans.
I'd probably be amazed, actually.
Yeah, you'd be shocked. Yeah, no, you might intuit it.
I knew what a quid was, but I wanted an explanation. And the only reason I knew what it was is from the movie that I saw as a small child. Like I kind of had to look it up, but I did want to know. Like, I mean, I've always just kind of assumed I knew what it was.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a nice word, quid.
It's a good word.
Yeah.
Okay, so shall we proceed?
Let's do it.
Okay. Last week we talked about Article 1, the House. We talked about what a chaotic and wondrous representation of the people of this nation that it is.
Indeed.
Excuse me. This week we're going to talk about the Senate. And we alluded last week that a lot of people think maybe the Senate shouldn't exist. I could not disagree with that more. And to explain why I disagree with that, we'll have to go to the history of the Senate for one particular reason.
Okay.
That particular reason is for 125 years of our history, we did not elect senators.
Okay. All right. That's new. That's new information to me. Yeah.
It's new information to most people, actually. In 1912, when the 17th Amendment was ratified, that's when the election, the direct election of senators was part of the Constitution.
Okay.
Before that, constitutionally, before that, senators were to be elected, or more chosen, I guess. Well, it's the same, really, by the state legislature which they were representing.
Okay.
It was a part of what was called the Connecticut Compromise. Connecticut was a smaller state at the time, and they did not want to lose. They did not want to have less representation than they felt that they deserved. So the Senate, which is a mirror of the House of Lords in England, although not a lifetime appointment like the House of Lords was, but might still be. You know more about that than me, though.
Yeah, this fucker stay on forever.
It's still a lifetime appointment? That's horrible. Are they still appointed by the Queen?
There's no, I don't think they are. But there's like a weird thing where there's a particular what's the word? Like a borough. There's a particular. It's a fictional place that they become a member of when they want to retire, because they can't retire because it's a for life appointment. So when they retire, they instead become a politician that serves this fictional place. and that's a true story.
Cheerio, Chip. Anyway.
So it's a lovely holiday here with Mary Poppins.
Well, okay. So one of the things we have to remember about the unique thing about the Constitution. Okay. So if we look at a Constitution, not the U.S. Constitution, but a Constitution, which is an organization of states, generally until the U.S. Constitution, something that would mirror a Constitution was your primary allegiance was to the state or province or whatever your country might call your region. Yeah. Your primary allegiance was to that region, at that, you know, politically boundaried region.
Yeah.
And then your secondary allegiance was to the federal government.
Okay.
And that came from feudalism, you know, like your primary allegiance was to your lord before the king.
Yeah.
Well, like if your lord said, we're going to fight the king, you go fight the king.
Yeah.
The United States, our framers didn't want that. They wanted a bit heavier hand. They didn't want what happened in the Civil War, basically.
Oh.
So they put more power in the hands of the federal government than had ever, of the central government, I guess might be a better way of putting that, than had ever been given before.
Okay.
And the Senate was one of the primary ways they did that. Because it's a longer term, and in the context of it being picked by the state legislature in particular to represent in Washington, it served as a moderating influence on the House. Like, even though, strictly speaking, the House is considered the people and the people are considered the government does need to have a certain say in what the people want. That's the symbiotic relationship, you know?
Yeah. That makes sense.
Like, well, mostly because there's more information held in the government than there is, you know, in my household.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're elected partly to be an advisory thing, right? To their guiding hand to some degree. That's like part of their explicit job.
That's exactly right. That we were going to go into the powers that were given to them was to tell the executive to temper the House's laws on the way to the executive, right? Because now remember, the Senate doesn't have the power of the purse. Only the House does.
Right.
So they were also, their responsibility was to make sure that the executive appointed people in charge of agencies that the House had created, right? But to make sure those people weren't too partisan or too crazy or too whatever they didn't want them to be in that current legislative cycle.
Okay. Yeah.
And we're not really talking about parties right now, because really the parties that existed either don't exist or they're so different than what they are now that the parties don't really matter in the context of what we're saying right now.
Yeah, absolutely. You go back far enough and they're,
it becomes
essentially talking about something else. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's not the same as they are now. And then the other major, major power, and the Senate is unique in that it's a subset of an article that has a whole lot of power over two of the other articles and meaning branches of government, in that it tells the executive who it can and can't hire, and it tells the courts who can or can't be a judge.
Okay.
Which is a big deal in a rule of law nation.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. Yeah. It really is.
So, so we have the Senate, and the reason that the Senate has become so much more prominent lately, because it used to be the Senate is a quiet place generally. They don't really argue a lot like they do in the House, and they surely don't scream at each other across the floor. I don't know if you saw recent C-SPAN Senate action, but it's enough to put you to sleep.
You know, oddly enough, I've seen bits of C-SPAN over the years in the times that I was in the U.S. because I was kind of curious about it. But yeah, I haven't seen any in ages.
Well, there's a whole lot. Since there's only 50 senators, they have a whole lot more power than the people in the House do individually.
Uh-huh.
That's why you end up with like Lisa Murkowski's, you know, or Susan Collins, rather, you know, who him haws around everything, even though you know which way she's going to vote. Well, the reason it matters is because there's only 100 votes. There's only ever 100 votes. And so every vote is much more important. Like, I remember a line from a movie years ago. I don't remember what movie it is, but it always struck me as something telling, and that my son's going to be the president or at least a senator.
Right.
So there's a whole lot of power there, especially when you think about the republic system, giving the states a high amount of power to run their own governments and their own economies. If you have only two representatives in Washington from a sovereign state in the larger context of what a state means,
then
they're going to have a lot of power inside of that government, especially in the state government. Like Mitch McConnell's an enormously powerful guy in Kentucky.
That makes sense.
So if the Senate doesn't work right, which is not currently, like anything else, it has the potential to break the system. Because, you know, the reference that we've used for the tripod, right?
Yeah.
And for those who haven't listened, Frank Herbert said the tripod is the most unstable of all political organizations. That's not the exact quote, but that's pretty close.
Yeah. And in our previous, sorry to interrupt you. I didn't mean to there. In our previous context for it, what were the three legs of the tripod that we were talking about before?
The tripod we had been talking about before was the tripod of support for the Republican Party as far as the voting base goes. And they had the fiscal conservatives, the social conservatives, and the, I guess you could call them foreign interventionists. Yeah. Made me say that word.
The hawks. we just call them hawks. You'll have heard that in a previous episode if you've been listening before, and if not, go and check it out.
8, 9, and 10, I believe it was.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, good episodes.
I enjoyed them.
I did too. So, okay, where were we? We were at the tripod. Yeah, my government is based on the tripod. When you think about it. Well, actually, you don't even have to think about it. There's three branches of my government. It's a little scary, isn't it?
It is. And that's one of those things, though, even as someone, like long before I had like a real interest in American politics, I would always hear, the three branches, you know, because there'd be discussion about, maybe they'll get all three branches or, you know, they've only got one branch. But, you know, for the longest time, I didn't really understand what that meant, you know, what those three branches were and how they interacted, you know.
Do you want like a real nutshell circular? I mean, I can give a real quick description if you think it might be helpful to folks listening.
Honestly, I'd love like a 2 to 5 minute or even a 30-second thing on it just to have it in place there. Because, you know, I've noticed we do have listeners who are not from from the U.S. And it is those little primers actually go a long way, I think.
Okay, great. We have the legislative branch and we have the executive branch and we have the judicial branch. The legislative branch is responsibility is to make laws and set the budgets and oversee the executive. The executive branch's job is to execute the laws, hence executive, and foreign policy. And these are the strictly constitutional, I mean, this has evolved. And then the judicial branch's sole job is to interpret the law that are written by Congress. We'll go into, we probably won't do Article 3 because I'm really, like, I would think that an attorney or someone who knows more about law would be better to explain the judicial branch. I could give somebody 10 minutes on it, but it would just be, you know, a paragraph I read somewhere that they could just easily read.
Yeah, but, I get you. And it's not strictly what we're on anyway.
Right. Yeah. So, but generally you see that there's a coexisting circle there.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, if one of them falls, then the whole system can come collapsing down. That's why, like when people, you just mentioned it, when people say maybe they can take all three branches.
Yeah.
That always gives me cringe when I hear that, because no political party should ever claim that they've taken the judicial branch, because the judicial branch is supposed to be nonpartisan.
Yeah. Do you think, I'm sorry, no, I'm getting ahead of myself.
No, that's our
question. Yeah. I just wonder, like, there's always such a public interest in what is the weight of the Supreme Court? Which way is it weighted in this current generation? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I wonder, for as long as that's been going on, the Supreme Court isn't really nonpartisan.
The Senate made the Supreme Court partisan.
Okay.
Like, that fits into what we're talking about. Almost.
Love it.
Well, Mitch McConnell took the lead of the House that had been happening for, what, three speakers beforehand that politicized everything. So Mitch McConnell did the same. Plus, there's always been a long-standing desire, as we talked about, in the social conservative wing of the Republican Party to get rid of Roe v. Wade. And the only way that they could do that was to take over the courts.
Right.
So we'll go, okay, because that's part of the Senate's power. Like, that's really maybe their most important power, given that we're a nation of laws, and to see that power abused into a place where people can say we'll take all three branches, that's because the Senate is broken. Like, they didn't used to say that. No one ever used to say that when I was a kid. We'll take the court. Nobody ever said that.
Yeah.
Why are attorneys able to shop around for judges? The judicial branch of our government is very, very, it's very, very, that's terrible. It's filled with a patchwork of different systems for getting judges into the courts. It's not uniform across the nation. Some places appoint them, some places elect them, some places have longer terms or shorter terms. Sometimes they can't run as partisans, sometimes they can. It's a system that has been a victim of the legislative branch of states and the federal government for quite some time because it's passive.
That's quite shocking to hear, actually, that sometimes they can run as partisan, because the idea is that at some point as they rise through the ranks, they should stop being partisan, if I understand correctly. I mean, it'll be known, but they'll have to officially say, oh, I'm not partisan, right?
Ideally.
And it's such a strange thing that they can campaign as that thing, and then we are to assume that they just stop being that thing at a certain point in their career.
It might be best illustrated by, I would say, maybe John Roberts' confirmation hearing in the Senate.
Okay.
You'll hear judges say, when they're going through confirmation, they'll say, I'm just an umpire. I don't call balls and strikes.
Okay.
Well, that's what umpires do, eh? I mean, that's literally what they do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no baseball expert, but I see a flaw. Okay. But yeah, go on.
The analogy is supposed to mean that I'm above the fray. I'm above the game. I'm above your politics. Not in a I'm better than you've kind of fashion, but that I don't care about your politics is what the analogy is supposed to mean.
Yeah, it's not convincing, is it?
Well, if you look at the Senate and how senators act because of the massive amount of power that they have, even in, like, you know, I told you the Senate's real boring to watch. Senators in general, other than characters like maybe Lindsey Graham, John McCain was kind of a character. That guy Kennedy from, I want to say, Mississippi, he's a bit of a character. Mm. Senators in general, as far as talking, are less is more types.
Okay.
They really, really, really try hard to parse their words because their words carry so much weight. It was one of the reasons why Lindsey Graham is turning out to be such a terrible legislator, because he doesn't seem to understand that. That every utterance he makes is historical posterity. Like in the House, there's 400 some members, and they're all talking all the time to news people and to newspapers and to cameras and to constituents, and they're always saying things, right?
Right.
It gets lost in the shuffle. But if you only got 50 senators, and I'd say probably 70% of the senators that sit there, you never even hear anything from. They don't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, when you look at the size of the Senate and how many people that we actually know by name, it's not a large percentage.
No, no, it's really not. It's really not.
So the ones that, right. So the ones that we do hear from, their words are that more important, that much more important.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, the appointment by state legislatures increased that. I think that the popular vote might have decreased the importance of senators' words a bit as far as moving the federal gauge, but not as far as their own electability.
Can you go into that a bit more for me?
Well, okay. Let's say that you have a senator whose pet project is maybe the EPA. Okay.
Yeah.
If that senator says, well, we're looking at reappropriating funds from this particular agency of the EPA, maybe say water management, and putting it to this particular section of the EPA, maybe Superfund cleanups, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a big deal. That's millions of dollars that one senator can only really needs to con, what, 10 senators or so, because they generally vote as a partisan pack in the Senate and always have. So there's more power rested in the federal government from one senator trying to enact a change or talk about a change, but it diminishes the power of their voice because now they're popularly elected rather than they only have to influence a smaller amount of state legislature members.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
You with me?
Yeah. So they just have to toe the line on a few issues.
Right. Senators are freer to vote their will than House members generally are.
Okay.
Because of the nature of a statewide election, they have constituents that they can count on either side of a whole lot of issues in most states. Like Texas, maybe not so much. That's why Ted Cruz always gets away with voting red as can, because, you know, he knows that his constituents are going to appreciate that more than him voting with Democrats.
Right.
And primaries. It's always about the primaries.
Yeah.
So I want to talk just a bit about how come we elect them, because it matters in the context of our broken Senate today. Because the 17th Amendment came about because the Senate was far, far more broken than it is today.
Okay.
This all happened. Most of this started happening in the late 1800s. It can carried on until about 1905. What you started getting was, because it was this post-Civil War, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is Industrial Revolution. This is the westward expansion. These are the three major historical contexts of the Senate being broken in the late 1800s, okay?
Okay.
So what you have are brand new state legislatures out west who really, I mean, they've just set up constitutions and they've just set up their governments. And I mean, literally, like Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Colorado, all these states, you know, they're new. Figuratively speaking.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're having a lot of trouble agreeing on who to send to the Senate.
Oh.
So much so that at one point, and it was, I want to say the 1890s, a third of Oregon state legislature refused to be sworn in.
What? Really?
Yeah, over a Senate pick.
Wow.
Indiana went 2 years with an empty Senate seat because they couldn't agree on one to send to the federal government, to Washington.
No.
And this was going on all over.
That
it was also
wild.
Going on. Well, yeah, and why don't they talk about that? I mean, that's a huge part of American history.
Yeah.
So you have Reconstruction going on in the South, and you have states that are desperately trying to hold on to white power while the federal government is forcing them to elect black legislatures, right?
Right.
At least locally, and at least on the state level. So then you have on the state level, you have a disagreement on what kind of senators they're going to. And you know what I mean? I mean, like, are we going to send the black guy? Or are we going to send the white guy? And it was all men. We're not. We'll just give that as a given. It was all men back then.
Of course. Yeah.
So you have a dearth of states that are sending either corrupt people to Washington because their states aren't functioning right. Nobody to Washington, or nobody generally. Meanwhile, you have companies like U.S. Oil and U.S. Steel booming. This was one of the things that created the Gilded Age.
Because this created... Yeah, sorry, because I'm thinking, because this created like a lack of oversight? Because this, because it was like there was nobody watching the store?
Half of Article 1 was broken.
Wow, that's a really fascinating piece of history.
Well, I don't know why it's not talked about more. And the context is so important, too. It was broken to the point that they couldn't even pass stuff.
Wow. What an opportunity for a certain type of person.
Well, U.S. Oil and U.S. Steel, people like Carnegie or Rockefellers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and it was an opportunity. The federal government became enormously corrupt at the end of the 1800s and into the early 1900s. Enormously corrupt. A lot of the anti-corruption rules, laws that are on the books today are still because of fixing that.
Wow.
Well, in, what was it, 1912? Yeah, 19, is that right? 1912? Hold on, let me look at my notes.
1912, you said.
Yeah. The 17th Amendment was passed. And the direct election of senators was put into law. It took about 6 years for all the appointed ones to cycle out, of course, because you had to go through a whole election cycle. The amendment also appointed the ability of states to be able to hold their own special elections to fill an empty Senate seat that might come empty during a term, or gave states the option to give governors the ability to appoint someone until a special election could be held.
Okay.
Both of those, I didn't mention in the first one, but both of those, the end result would be special election.
Right. Okay.
So they've codified it that they have to be elected by the people, but they've maintained the republic system just kind of on a knife edge, right?
Yeah.
Because the Senate still has the same advise and consent powers that it had.
Yeah.
Of the House, too, when you think about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
That's always the process. If the Senate passes the exact same law, which is doubtful because there's a lot of power in one senator, and if they want something for their state or for the federal government, they can insert an amendment as part of the debate process. Uh-huh. The Senate is known as the world's greatest deliberative body, hence why it's so boring.
Right.
And when you take it in the context, now we're going to move to the modern Senate. When you take that in the context of the modern Senate, until the Obama years, it worked on a system of trust. If you were going to filibuster, over time, they didn't make you hold the floor anymore, but you at least had to say who you were. I'm ex-senator, and I'm filibustering this law and I'm on this amendment. I'm filibustering this particular bill because I don't like an amendment or I don't like what the House did. Uh-huh. And you would have to say, at the very least, you'd have to say you were the one doing it and why. Now, there was a time where you had to actually stand on the Senate floor and do it. And in many states, you still do have to do that. In the federal government, that requirement was ended.
Okay.
Personally, I think that was a mistake, and we'll get into why.
Yeah.
Well, the trust, okay. In the Senate, they call each other distinguished gentlemen.
And nice.
Right. Well, House of Lords, right? Yeah. And, well, I mean, they do that because there is an unspoken trust of the rules in the Senate. There was an unspoken trust of the rules in the Senate. You knew that at the end of the day, because all these people had so much power, it was in their best interest to not shoot each other in the back, to do what they say they were going to do. In the House, you can get away with saying you were going to back a bill to someone of the opposing party or even of your own party, and then change your mind because it's chaotic there. The winds change quickly. Well, they don't change quickly in the Senate. So until the Obama years, it was if a senator said something, that word was bond.
Okay, yeah.
Well, because the Tea Party in 2010 went to Washington just to fuck with the black guy, and I mean that. Like, that's the way I feel about it. That they went there.
Yeah.
Maybe not the people that voted for them, right? Like, it's hard for me to always make that distinction, even though it's in my mind. I sometimes forget to make that distinction. But maybe not the people that voted for Tea Party people, but there sure were a lot of signs that were racist and bigoted that were displayed as part of the Tea Party wave in 2009 to get them into office in 2010. So there's definitely undertones of racism in that movement.
Yeah. Those are shocking to look at. But sorry, yeah, go on. Yeah.
They are shocking to look at. Actually, yeah. You know what's most shocking to me is that I have to remind people. Like, I literally have to remind my fellow countrymen, don't you remember that Mick Mulvaney at his events, they were holding up Obama as a monkey signs? Don't you remember that? So that's why it wasn't surprising to me that the appeal to Trump was almost instantaneous when he renounced in 2015. That's why I told my friend, that guy's going to win the nomination. Because they'd already put it in their party. It was already baked into the cake. And it was baked into the cake for the Southern strategy with Nixon, but it didn't come out into the open until we had a black president.
Yeah.
So we get these Tea Party guys that come in, right? And their mandate to themselves is basically, we're just here to fuck with the president. Okay.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz is a Tea Partier. He was elected in 2010. He's a classic example of an over the top, hypocritical, I have to be relevant Tea Party Republican politician. You see why, right?
Tell me why.
Well, over the top in the Senate is voting for a national emergency you know is unconstitutional.
Oh, yeah.
That's over the top for a senator. That vote is a big deal.
Yeah.
And if the philosophical underpinnings of conservatism were true and real still to this day, of constitutional conservatism, if that was still really a part of their party, then every senator that voted for that national emergency would be drummed out of office, primaried from the right, strictly speaking, because that would be to the right of the position they took on that vote, politically, philosophically speaking.
Yeah. And that's something we talked about a few times, isn't it?
You mentioned it was last week or the week before. I think it was last week. You mentioned that you're not sure there are any more constitutional conservatives.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical.
I would say in the elected class of Republicans currently, that's a true statement. Well, I should rephrase that. In the ones that we hear from.
Right.
It's important for us to remember that as we discuss these things and what the problems are, that we really do only know a fraction of the senators. And we really do only know a very, very, very small fraction of the people in the House.
Yeah. But there's a couple of things we do know. Like, for one, we broadly know their voting record. Like, very broadly, right?
Actually, we know exactly their voting record. You can go to Ballotpedia, Ballotpedia.com, anytime you want, and you can look up any legislature, state or federal. You can look up their voting record in detail.
But I mean, even in a casual way, we broadly know their voting record. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think that's more a product of the partisanship that has hit my nation. It did used to be that senators occasionally would vote across party lines, depending on what state they're from and what the issue might have been. But yeah, it's become so partisan that if you fear a primary from your base for voting against your party, then yeah, you're always going to vote with your party.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely talking about, like, at the moment. And so that's one thing. And then the second thing we know is that whatever ethical problems they may have with the direction of the party, and however the direction of the party may be opposed to their constitutional conservatism, they haven't decided to walk away.
Well,
or to speak out.
Well, some of that, Connor, I would say, goes to what we talked about in our gerrymandering episode, in that they have reduced their base to the point that it does agree with what Donald Trump is doing, so that if they want to maintain any relevance or power within their party, they have to they're being led around by their base now.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that that disqualifies them from being an ethical constitutional conservative.
You're not a leader if the people you're supposed to be leading are telling you what to do all the time.
Exclusively. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's not a leader. That's just another person.
Yeah. And it's not a servant either, because they're not really serving the people.
No, they're really not. Especially when you talk about a senator whose entire function is to moderate the mob, as it were.
Right.
I mean, that's the Senate's sole purpose constitutionally, as far as it being in the legislative branch. It's its primary purpose is to moderate the mob. And if the mob's leading a senator around by the nose, then he's not a senator. He should be in the House of Representatives.
The inmates have taken over the asylum, essentially, in that example.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, before we go any further, I missed something really major. I wanted to point out that was part of the context of why the system was so broken before, but like there are even more parallels. William Randolph Hearst was the primary media pusher of the ratification of the 17th Amendment. Did you know that?
That's, again, that's a really interesting piece of history. And I certainly did not know that.
It really is interesting. One could assume that as a business owner, I didn't really read deep into it because I got a different message out of it. But one could assume that as a business owner, he was probably looking for continuity of regulations across state lines.
Okay.
One could assume. I don't know that that was really a problem back then. When you talk about the late 1800s, it's literally the old Wild West. So
yeah,
it's kind of hard to, the context is different. We were technically a nation of laws, but they were so localized that it was a patchwork of things.
Yeah. Okay.
But the reason the message I got out of the William Randolph first thing was that even if the media at the time of this, and it really was, when you think about it, a governmental collapse. I mean, an entire branch wasn't working correctly. And the media, you know, by far, William Randolph Hearst was the most heard man in the media at the time. if he was still one-sided and we still got out of it. So, like, even if the media is one-sided now, we still get out of it because the pattern is there.
Yeah.
Believe me. Do you not agree with that?
I do. It's just a really interesting thought. Like, yeah, it's cool. I, you know, when we started doing this podcast, it didn't occur to me that at some point we'd be talking about, you know, a 1912 ratification involving William Randolph Hearst.
I was really worried this today's would be super dry because of that kind of stuff.
Well, you see, maybe, yeah, I'm showing how much of a dork I am then, because I'm like super pumped about it. I'm really excited by that. I'm like, holy shit, too. William Randolph Hearst? He's like, yeah, right. the dude from Citizen Kane, you know? It's exciting.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The thing about politics that I've discovered is that generally, we've been here before.
Right. Generally. Yeah.
The uniqueness of the moment that we're in now is that, like, we had a functioning executive back then, and generally we had a functioning court system back then, and I'm not sure that we have fully functioning all three branches of government right now.
Yeah. So
that's really kind of what makes it scary.
Yeah. What is a tripod called when all three legs collapse?
Broken?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was quick and easy. All right, good, yeah.
Ground? I don't know.
Yeah, just like the floor? Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, we also, I mean, yeah, we're going through a new industrial revolution. It's not industrial, it's digital, right?
Right.
But we didn't just have a civil war.
Yeah.
Like, all the other context of that is that this country was economically devastated at the time. Thanks to Obama, not so much.
Yeah.
So we're gonna come back to the modern Senate. So I really wanted to get just a little bit more about why particularly it's broken. Because I think that if people see something that's broken, they can see that it needs to be fixed and not destroyed.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Not just cast aside, but repaired. Yeah.
Right. Right. Because there's a reason for it. And it's a good reason. We've talked about the reasons, and they're good reasons. Like, they're the primary check on the executive as far as how the executive goes about executing the law. They're the primary check on that.
Yeah.
So right around 2010, when the Tea Party wave comes in, you already got guys like Ted Cruz coming in, and they are there just to tell Obama no over and over again. And around this time, the rules change that in the Senate, that a senator no longer has to say that they're the one filibustering a law, or a bill, rather. That they don't have to say they're the one filibustering a particular amendment. Now, the reason that matters is because if, let's say, we'll just grab Kristen Gillibrand. She had a bit of a sketchy record on gun rights before. She comes from a rural place. So she had to evolve into where she is now. Okay.
Okay.
I'm saying that completely disconnected. I know that people have opinions about that, but that's just the fact of it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And if she had decided that she wanted to filibuster, let's say, a universal background check law 10 years ago, okay, or whatever, if she can do it anonymously, then it can't be used against her in campaign ads.
Yeah, that's worrying.
So what they did by taking away the face of the person who's holding up the progress of the Senate is disenabled the constitutional voting check on that particular senator.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. That's huge.
Huge. Like a little tiny rule change like that, because that place is so governed by rules that little rules matter a whole lot.
Absolutely.
So, like, look, okay, let's take the blue slips. You know what blue slips are?
No.
Okay. A vestige of the state's influence on the Senate is what's called the blue slip. And what happens is, well, what's supposed to happen is that, because this is broken now too, another Mitch McConnell break. What's supposed to happen is that as a judge comes before the Senate, because they do, like, what they did for Kavanaugh and what they did for Roberts and what they did for Gorsuch, right? That happens to every single judge. It's not, we just don't see those. They're not as exciting. It's not exciting to see. I mean, it is to me, but not to everybody, unless it's a controversial nominee. It's not very exciting to see circuit court judge, you know, Joe Blow get confirmed. Generally, yeah, it's a rubber stamp. Generally. And the reason it would generally be a rubber stamp is because a particular, the two senators from a particular state have the ability to blue slip approval, a court appointment in their state. Did I explain that right?
What is the blue slip, though?
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for, yeah, we're okay with putting this judge in our state.
I'm sorry. Okay, because I'd never heard the expression blue slip before. Okay, so they can just give the nod.
That's what it is. I'm assuming that at some point it was an actual blue slip.
Uh-huh.
But now it's just an approval.
Okay.
Well, if let's so, and what it would do, I'm not real sure that it was the best system to go about doing it, but the ramifications of not having it have been far worse than having it. Because the effect of the blue slip, what it was like, let's say you were two senators from Georgia, uh-huh, and there was you're both Republicans, we'll say. And there's a Democratic president, and he wants to appoint somebody who's a little more on the liberal side to a circuit court in your state.
Right.
Well, if you don't want that, if you want your courts to maintain the ideological balance that you prefer, then you don't blue slip it.
Okay.
And then the president is forced to go back and pick somebody who's a little closer to your liking.
Yeah.
Generally, that's part of the finding that that's supposed to be the find the middle of the road candidate function that the Senate is supposed to have, tempering the mob.
Okay.
Right? Because there's a little bit of the mob in the president. A little bit. Maybe not so much with the Electoral College system, but a little bit of the mob in the president. Mm-hmm. In the chief executive, I guess, would be the best way to put that.
Yeah.
If you take away the blue slips, what you have is senators not able to influence what kind of lawmaker goes into their state. So then the president is able to appoint whoever he wants. And then if the majority doesn't happen to be the majority that the two senators in your state are in, you're getting stuck with judges who don't really fit your state.
Right.
So when Obama came to office, and McConnell got some power, if you take away, if you make the filibuster anonymous, then suddenly all the Republican senators anonymously started filibustering every single judge that came from Obama. Not just the ones I didn't like, all of them. So that by the time of the end of the Obama administration, we were in a terrible, terrible place judicially in this nation. It had hobbled an entire branch of our government.
That's so awful.
All because Mitch McConnell wanted to maintain the power of the Republican base still voting for them by saying, we're working for judges for you. That's the only reason, in my opinion, that the less inclined to be fundamentalist Christians still support Donald Trump is because of the judge appointments.
Right.
Because they're hoping it'll get rid of Roe v. Wade and Obergefell versus the United States. Is that what it was? It was Obergefell versus the United States, wasn't it?
What's that one?
That was the gay marriage.
Okay. Okay.
Decision. They want those overturned. I mean, they have a deep philosophical and religious objection to those two concepts. And Mitch McConnell told them, if you keep voting for us, we'll make sure you get that. Knowing that they can't change it legislatively, the only other option they have is to change the court system. So during the Obama years, Republicans hobbled it. The Senate Republicans hobbled the court system. We were something like 40% low on judges. Like, one of the reasons that there's such a problem at the southern border is because there are no immigration judges down there. I mean, there are some, of course. No is strictly speaking not true, but there are far, far, far more cases than there are judges to take those cases. So
right.
If you come in, that's why you get a court appointment 2 years from when you applied for asylum, because the backlog's that big, because the Senate.
Things like this kind of blow my mind, because I know that we use the word, I certainly use the word treason way too much and far too lightly, you know, and I realize that it has a wartime context and stuff like that, but actively taking, actively pursuing something that is against the best interests of the government that you serve, and that just being something, well, yeah, that's what you do. It's fine. That I still find that shocking.
I don't know that I would call that treasonous, given that treason is
a
term. But
it's not. My emotional response to it is treason, but I know that's technically not what that is. You know what I mean? But it's still betraying your government. I'm uncomfortable with terms like patriotism and stuff like that. But that sounds to me deeply unpatriotic.
I would say for someone to have taken the oath to a constitution and then to disregard that constitution in the sake of partisan power would be anti-democratic at the very least.
Well, that is so much better than I put it. Yeah.
But I like treason. So I'm good with treason.
Yeah. I mean, look, we all like treason. Yeah.
It's staggering to me. Like, and you know, the funny thing is that Mitch McConnell is universally derided or universally hated. People hate Mitch McConnell. They don't even like him in the Senate. He's not real easy to get along with. He's not an affable guy, but he is brilliant at working the system. Like, take the nuclear option, for example. You know about it used to be that. So we'll take it back to when McConnell was filibustering all of Obama's judges, right?
Okay.
So what Harry Reid decided he wanted to do, because, you know, he knew that we were having trouble with our judicial system falling into the drain. You only need a simple majority in the Senate to change a rule. You don't need a supermajority. You just need 51 votes to change a rule in the Senate.
Okay.
It doesn't happen often because it runs on rules, right? Well, Harry Reid took the controversial step, and in my opinion, he was forced into it. It was maybe the shrewdest move in the Senate I've seen in my lifetime that I know of. Mitch McConnell forced Harry Reid into changing the rules so that anything below a Supreme Court justice appointment could not be filibustered. So, but he did it late. He did it really late. He didn't want to do it because, like when we talk about the emergency power with Trump, you know, the next president could use that emergency power. Well, the same thing applies for all government officials.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of debate. Should Harry Reid change this rule? Should Harry Reid not change this rule? What happens in the long run if they lose the power, which they did shortly thereafter?
Yeah.
So as soon as Kavanaugh came up, Mitch McConnell had a simple majority vote to get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court justices.
Oh, ooh, he's a wily one.
Right. And well, he actually warned Harry Reid, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, I'll take advantage of it. And he did. He did exactly what he said he was going to do in that situation.
Yeah.
So, the Senate now is incapable of middle-of-the-road decisions. It has become as partisan as the House. And that's why it's broken. But it's not half as broken as it was in the Industrial Revolution. I mean, at least everybody's there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, and there is the hope. I mean, there is a bit of hope in that 12 senators did vote against their party's representative, their party's president for this national emergency thing. And that's hopeful. It's not awesome, but they're on the record, and a vote is always on the record.
Yeah.
That's the Senate, buddy. We came up to how it started and how it's broken from all the way up to how it was, and then we fixed it, and then it's broken again.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, I enjoyed that. I'm still excited about the whole Gilded Age William Randolph Hearst thing. You know, it blows my mind when I'm a fan of Westerns, right? I'm going to try and keep this a short tangent. I'm a big fan of Westerns. And, you know, the period that we think of as like the Wild West is this really, really, really short time. And it blows my mind that it's barely out of living memory.
Oh, for sure. When I was a kid, my great-great-grandmother used to tell me stories.
I mean, that is amazing, you know?
She traveled on a wooden, you know, in a covered cart. And, you know, like they had to put bags on her dog's feet because they walked so far.
Wow.
Yeah. That, I mean, like the westward expansion is just out of living memory in this country.
Right. Barely, right?
Barely. Yeah, just barely.
Just barely, yeah.
I find that interesting. You were able to romanticize something so quickly, though. It really was only, I mean, the Wild West period you speak of really was only about 15 or 20 years.
But that romanticizing was going on as it was happening. There was an active effort to romanticize the whole Manifest Destiny thing as it was happening, right?
Oh, yeah. And let's not even get into, that was just the government. Let's not even get into the advent of pulp novels and the media capitalizing on the, quote, romanticism, end quote, of the Wild West.
I feel like that's a Watcher episode for the future.
I don't know.
We'll treat ourselves.
Yeah, you know?
Say that again?
I don't know that I'm well-versed enough on the westward expansion and Wild West period.
We can get there.
Yeah, we probably could. I'd read up on it. You know, I read up on the shows anyway.
Look, man, it's on the board. That's it.
Oh, well, then it is what it is.
Yeah.
But one other happy note before we let it go.
Yeah.
The chances of Mitch McConnell getting reelected are getting slimmer and slimmer by the day. So it could very well be that Teresa Weasel's going to get the fuck out of there.
Okay. That's good. That's a good one to end on.
Okay.
All right, folks. Thanks for joining us. I hope you were as excited as I was about the Citizen Kane reference. And we'll talk to you next week.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.